Tonight, we are dealing with the seals. Now, just from glancing at the book of Revelation, you're able to see very easily that there are three sets of seven judgments. You have the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. The seals, trumpets, and bowls. Now, the trumpets and the bowls are actually very similar. I mean, they're different in their execution, but they're similar in the fact that the trumpets and the bowls parallel the Exodus plagues. And once we get to chapters 10 or 9, or the end of 8, 9, and even chapter 11 with the trumpets, and then we get to 16 with the bowls, we'll really dive into that more deeply, that the Exodus plagues really parallel what we have going into in those two judgments. The seals is different, though. The seals is different from the other two in that it does not parallel the Exodus plagues at all. I mean, the same concept is there of judgment, but you will not see the Exodus plagues like you see in the other two judgments. And there's a significant reason for that. Now, this is what I want to point out right off the bat. This is how we take the Old Testament and see how it applies to Revelation. There is a reason why that the plagues are attached to the last two, and the reason why that the plagues are not attached to the first one. And the answer comes in, what was the purpose of the Exodus plagues? In the time of Exodus, what was their purpose?
Letting go.
Specifically targeting the Egyptians so that they will let God's people go. The plagues themselves did not touch the Israelites at all. It was the Israelites walking around where there's darkness everywhere, and the Israelites are the ones that are able to see. It was the Israelites that had the blood over their doorposts whenever the angel of death came, and they were the ones that were spared of the judgment. The judgment was for the Egyptians with the intention of getting them to repent, to turn around, to treat God and His people appropriately. So if the plagues, the Exodus plagues then, really are attached parallel to these last two, the trumpets and the bowls, what does that probably say about the trumpets and the bowls? Who are these judgments about? Yeah, Rome, the evil. The evil people. The reason why the plagues are attached to these two and not to this one is because the plagues of the Exodus, like these, the trumpets and the bowls, are attached to the evil people. They're for the evil. The seals are different, though. The seals are different because they're going to be talking to the Christian people about the way in which they will experience, or what will their experience be during the lifetime in which judgments are dealt out. Will they be exempt from every sort of anxiety, or will they be exempt from every sort of punishment or persecution, or will they get caught up in it? And that's kind of what the seals is addressing, and it makes sense also why the seal starts off the judgments. Because God is wanting to make sure that His people has His message first, and then He will eventually get to talking about these other people. But the seals is going to be asking the question, or answering the question, what in the world are Christians going to look like whenever literally all hell is breaking loose? And is God in control? And that's what the seals, that's right off of the beautiful scene of the throne room of God, where sovereignty was exalted, where the Lamb was the one worthy of breaking the seals. We dive right into chapter 6. Chapter 6, I'm going to go ahead and read chunks tonight. I'll read about 8 verses and then we'll talk about the 8 verses. And if you have questions, then just try to interject them whenever we're talking about it. So, chapter 6, verse 1. It says, I watched as the Lamb. Who's the I?
John.
Watched as the Lamb, and the Lamb is? Jesus, exactly. I, John, watched as the Lamb, Jesus, opened the first of the 7 seals. Then I heard one of the 4 living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. When the Lamb opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. We'll talk about the word large there later, because that's actually not right. Verse 5. When the Lamb opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, come. I looked, and there before me was a black horse. Its rider was holding a pair of scales in his hands. Then I heard what sounded like a voice from among the 4 living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a day's wages, and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages. and do not damage the oil and the wine. When the Lamb opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the living creature say, Come. I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by all the wild beasts of the earth. The first thing I want to point out is this. There's a lot of crazy stuff happening in these first four seals. But I read all four of them together for a reason. Because these four seals, unlike the other plagues, well, no, a lot like the other plagues. These four seals, these four horsemen, you do not picture them riding, breaks the seal, one goes and does his thing. And then a little bit later, he breaks the other seal, and then that one goes and does his thing. They're riding together. This right off the bat is a perfect example of recapitulation. Perfect example. All four horses will be riding together, and what they do, we will talk about how they are linked together. But what I want to point out right off the bat is that while they are riding together, and while chaos seems to be running rampant, there is an underlying theme here of who is in charge. Consistently, we see who is in charge. Number one, the Lamb's in charge. Because every single one of these, in verse 1, in verse 3, in verse 5, in verse 7, every single one of them is only able to move whenever the Lamb breaks a seal. The Lamb breaks the seal, and under His sovereignty, they're able to ride. Then you also see the sovereignty of the throne or around the throne, because the living creatures are the ones that deliver the message of the Lamb. The seal breaks, and one of the living creatures says, Come. Same thing for the second, the third, the fourth. And notice, it's interesting, that there are four seals in which four living creatures are playing a part. Okay, the third thing is... What's that? Go ahead.
Talking about four other creatures with riders.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and there's a reason why it's four. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, you pick up, remember we talked about last week with numbers. Not only whenever the number is specifically stated, but also the rhetorical numbers. He names four... There's four horsemen for a reason. Because we're going to be talking about the complete judgment, the complete chaos on the earth. Complete, number four. And we'll get to that. That'll become more clear in a minute. But there is a third underlying sovereignty. Not just the Lamb, not just living creatures. But God's in this as well. If you notice, in verse 2, it says, at the very end, it says, Its rider held a bow and he was given a crown. And then you also see in verse 4, this happens twice in verse 4, then another horse came out, a fiery red one. Its rider was given power to take peace from the earth and to make men slay each other. To him was given a large sword. You see the same thing in verse 8, and we'll see the same thing in verse 11. There is a given motif that's wrapped up in all of these seals. And the question we need to ask is, given by whom? Who is the one giving the rider, the bow, and the giving the rider the power, and giving it's the throne, it's God, the unnamed giver of the authority, the power. What I'm trying to point out here is this, is that even though these riders look crazy, and even though these plagues, especially the fifth or the sixth seal, are insane, God is in control. And that is something that Revelation chapter 2 and 3, those churches needed to hear. God is in control. I know things are going chaotic. I know people are coming at you. And in a minute here, we'll even talk about how John basically says, I know you're going to get caught up and die. But God's still in control. Don't let anyone fool you. The one that is reigning is God. Okay, now, we come to the four horsemen, and I want to make sure, I actually had a couple emails this past weekend. I said to this person, I just said, they were asking good questions, intuitive questions that we need to keep asking. And yet we have to make sure that our questions aren't missing the point. Because sometimes we can focus on one little detail so much that you miss the point of the... Remember I showed that one picture before where it was zoomed in on this blob. And you didn't know what it was. And then I zoomed out a little bit and you saw that it was like an arm. Zoomed out a little bit, you saw a hand attached to it. A little bit more, you saw my daughter. And then you zoomed out one more time and you realize my daughter is actually separated from my family because we're trying to get her to come over for the family picture. And the point is if you're too focused in on one detail, you miss the whole picture. And you don't focus on one tree and you miss the whole forest. That's important for us to remember because when we come to the riders, people ask the wrong questions. They want to know the stuff like, who are the riders? And where are the riders coming from? And, you know, when will this happen? You're asking, the question we need to ask is not, who are the four horsemen? But what do the four horsemen do? Because that's really what all is described here. Everything else is speculation. What is described here is what the four horsemen do. And so what I want to do is I want to look at each of the four horsemen. I want to look at the description they're given. I want to look at the purpose of that horseman, and then I want to kind of summarize what the symbolic meaning is of that particular horseman. Okay? So the first horseman we see a rider on the white horse. The first two verses, the seal is broken, the living creature says come, and a rider on the white horse comes. And the description is he's given a bow, which is a weapon of war. Actually, a weapon of war that is very, very rare. It's a very skilled weapon of war. This is one of the reasons why the Romans had such a difficult time with the Parthians in the east. Because the Parthians, which look strikingly similar to the scorpions, or the locust in Revelation 9, but they would be coming, they'd be wearing this hideous mask with like hair flowing, and they'd be coming and they would be able to shoot a bow while they're riding a horse. That is not easy. Very difficult to be accurate in doing that. But it is a weapon of war. It is a key weapon of war. He has a bow, but he's also given a crown. Now, what would a crown symbolize? Just think as practical as you can. If you have a crown, what does that symbolize about you?
Reigning.
Yeah, reigning. Power, authority, dominion. So not only is this horseman given a bow, but he's also given authority to wield the bow. And what he ends up doing, his purpose is to go out and conquer. Is to go out and conquer and make war. And what we're going to see is the four horsemen are not some distant in the future four horsemen that are yet to come. It's a description of the way in which the world functions. It's the way in which the world... When has there not been a time when somebody was sitting in a position of authority that was longing and bent on conquest? Conquering. It's especially in their world. I mean, that was not just the description of Rome. That was the definition of Rome. Conquest. Alexander the Great before Rome. And all throughout history, even today, the empires of today are still bent on conquest. Because there is a limited amount of territory, and there is a vast amount of people, and the one who has the most territory and the most people usually has the most money. If you have the most money, you rule. You are the big dog on the block. So this first horseman is a description, symbolic description of human war that has as its goal conquering and conquest. The second horseman, again, what we're asking is, what are they described as? What would their purpose be with that description? And then asking the question, what does the symbol mean? The second horseman's the red horse. Oh, let me back up real quick, because we have some colors, and I do want to talk a little bit about colors, because colors are symbolic. They're purposefully attached to things. The color white, you will see throughout Revelation, always is a color of victory. You have the citizens that are lining the road road with white robes. And matter of fact, in the Roman world, white robes was a way in which after you conquered an enemy, the people, the citizens of the city would line the roads, hailing the emperor, or hailing the conquering general, wearing white robes. This would have made sense to them. White is a number that is attached to victory. And that's why you see Jesus in Revelation 19, he's riding on a white horse. Or the bride is dressed in fine linens of white. And then you see in the community, the army coming with Jesus in Revelation 19 are dressed in white robes. White is a color of victory. And here what you have is a conquering horseman that is not just like that he has the desire to be conquering. He is one that is victorious in his attempts. And then same thing with red. In Revelation, red is always attached to some sort of evil agent. All of these evil agents are always under the purview of God's sovereignty. But Revelation chapter 12, we will see a dragon that is red. A red dragon. Red, you also see in Revelation 17, the prostitute riding the red beast, the scarlet beast. Red is a color that's attached to evil agents. They are under the sovereignty of God, but they are still evil agents. Okay, so the red horse. The red horse is given power to take away peace. And it is given a sword, which was the key weapon of war. However, this word sword in verse, 4? It says in the NIV, he was given a large sword. The word for sword there is not a large sword. We will see a large sword if you look down in verse 8. says they were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword. That's a different word. And that word there, that sword there, is a big sword. Think of a big broad sword that you see like knights in the medieval times. That's the word in verse 8. But it is not the word here in verse 4. In verse 4, this sword is actually a small sword, a dagger, like a large dagger, but a small sword. And this sword, a lot of times, this is actually the same word that is used in Genesis 22 when Abraham has Isaac on the altar and he's going to sacrifice him with a small sword. That's what this sword is. Which is interesting, because when the peace is taken away by the red horse, we will see in the fifth seal that who is killed in this war, the perspective of the seals, they're talking about the Christians being killed. So I find it fascinating that the red warrior, the red horseman, is riding with a sword that is used in sacrifice settings. It's interesting. I don't want to push it too far. William Hendrickson in his book, More Than Conquerors, takes this, I think, way too far. But I do think there's an interesting connection there. Because in a minute here, we're going to find that the people that are being killed, that are caught in the middle of this, are Christians. Being sacrificed, in a sense. Which is fascinating, too, because the martyrs that we'll see, they're Christians at the end of at the fifth seal. They are under an altar, which is where you do sacrifices with a large dagger or a small sword. He's given a power to take away peace, and he's given a sword, which is a way or a key weapon of war. Now, this is interesting to me because that's the motivation of getting war. If you are bent on conquering, then you cannot be friends with the people that you don't own their land with. You know what I mean? If they're on the edge of your empire and you're wanting to expand your empire, you can't have peace with them. I mean, they can eventually realize how big you are and just kind of be absorbed into the empire. But more than likely, the reality is like the Parthians on the edge of the Roman Empire, they weren't friends. So what you have to do is you have to pull out peace so that a war can ensue and you can exert your power. And that's what this horseman does. That's his purpose. His purpose is to help the conquering one by taking away peace and by wielding a key weapon of war. So, the symbol here is to equip humanity to make war by providing enmity and weapons. Horseman number 3, the rider of the black horse. The black horse is, this rider is giving a pair of scales. Not scales like a fish, scales like a balance, a balancing scale. And he receives instructions from a heavenly voice. Now the purpose of this is actually is to describe a result of the first two horsemen. The first two horsemen are bent. Well, the first one's bent on conquest. The second one is taking away peace and is providing a way for wars to begin, in a sense. And the result of that is always an effect on economy. This is very easily proven in our day and age. It is very easily proven. That usually when wars are being waged, economies suffer. And that's just the way it is. Because wars cost a lot of money. They just cost a lot of stinking money. But it's what I find fascinating about this is that they're not just focused on the empire's budget. They're focused on who is suffering because of this economic strain. If you look, it says, a quart of wheat for a day's wages and 3 quarts of barley for a day's wages. A quart of wheat and 3 quarts of barley is equivalent to a day's worth of food. You see what's being said here? A day's wages buys you 1 day of food.
For one person.
Yeah, for one person. That doesn't count their family. Do you see the issue for the poor in this particular situation? But what I find interesting is that guess what is not touched? The oil or the wine. And guess what? If you're a poor person, you wouldn't be touching oil and wine anyway. But the economy does not help the poorest of the poor during times of war. It squashes them. But what it does help is a lot in this situation, the rich get helped. Because no damage is done to the oil and wine, the rich are still in abundance, while the poor is struggling to scrape by. This is a natural, throughout history, this is a natural result of war. Usually wars, the ones that get hit the hardest, are not either one of the two sides fighting, but the poor that are caught in the middle. It's just a conventional wisdom. It's the way it's always been, it's the way it is today, and it's the way it was then. And that's the third horseman, which makes sense in light of the first two.
Or black.
What's that?
The color black. Color black.
Color black. The color black, the only thing I could think of, because that one, I'm not as strong on the color black as I'd like to be. Because there's just not a whole lot of parallels between the first one and the second one. But I will say this. Black usually has the concept of some sort of evil or disaster. Disastrousness. Evil disaster. And the only reason why I can say that is... you know, you're talking about the parallels with darkness, you know, and relating that to black. But also, even in our day, we understand the concept of disaster being associated with black because in the 20s, when the stock market crashed, we had Black Tuesday. You had this concept of disaster, which even whenever you're at a funeral, black is because there is a disastrous moment in your life. So, and the only when I'm saying that, I don't feel so comfortable because I don't have a good Old Testament text, and I haven't found anything good in my reading of extra biblical literature yet to say that's what black means. But that's my best guess. So, take that for what it's worth. Same thing with what we're going to find here in a minute with the pale horse. The word it's actually green. It's actually green. It's not pale. Think of a sailor on a cartoon whenever he feels sick. And he's usually, in real life, we turn pale. But what they do in the cartoons is they make him turn green. Same idea. So you have the pale horse, but actually it's the green horse. The greenish, pale-looking horse. Which, again, there really is... Actually, that has even less evidence than black. What is the pale related to? There is a possible linguistic connection of the green horse being paralleled to the emerald field, the emerald rainbow around the throne. Problem is they're not the same word. So I mean, even I feel like I have to stretch to make it fit. And this is one of those times where if we cannot attach one of the minor details to a particular understanding, we just let it paint the picture. And so some of them we can say, no, without question, red he uses consistently in here to say this. Or white consistently. Black and green, I believe they mean something. I just don't believe I have enough information to say confidently what it is. But those are my best guesses. So, where were we? Oh, we finished the third horseman. Let's go on to the fourth one. This is the rider of the pale green horse. The rider of the pale green horse, his name is Death. And Death has Hades following behind him. And that makes perfect sense. Because what Death kills or gobbles, Hades swallows. Hades is the stomach of the mouth named Death. When somebody dies, especially when we're talking about evil here, evil dead, Hades, at this time would be more associated with the evil dead than the righteous. Because the evil go to this holding place for judgment, while the righteous go into the presence of God, which we'll see that in a minute at the fifth seal. But you have Hades following behind, and you will see Death and Hades be paired once more, and that's in Revelation chapter 20, 11 through 15, at the great day of judgment, when Death and Hades are thrown into the fiery lake. Because whenever eternity begins, death no longer is needed, and neither is Hades, because you're not waiting for anything anymore. It's come. Judgment's there. So Death and Hades are following this one, which again, this is describing a result of war. War does not only affect economies, it affects people's lives. And what's left in the wake of the rider of the white horse that is spurred on by the rider on the red horse is the rider on the black horse, economies, disaster. But you also have death. It's a natural consequence of wars. So this horseman is symbolic of the results of human war that destroys life as people lust for and kill for conquest, power, and hate. Now again, right here at the end, before we move on to the next seal, I want to emphasize the riders on the horses are riding together. They are riding together. You see how causally, they are connected. The warrior that is bent on conquest has to have peace lifted and enmity sown between the groups so that conquest can actually be pursued. When that happens, economies will be disastrous, but also people's lives will be lost. The four horsemen are a description of the history of the world. When in the history of the world have these four horsemen not been riding? Ever. Has there ever been a time when there was nobody bent on conquest, or there was no enmity sown between enemies, or whenever there was no economies affected by a war, whenever there was no people dying because of war? Never. I would almost venture to say there hasn't been a day in history in which these four horsemen weren't riding in some way, shape, or form. And the Christians in the first century would have known that because, again, Rome was defined by these four horsemen. This makes sense to them in their historical context. And as a result, there's going to be questions that are going to be asked. But what God is doing here is He's not just being redundant. He's offering them a divine perspective of the situation they're in. Rome is clearly riding on these four horsemen. But the question that the Christian needs to have answered is still God in control? Is He still in control whenever Rome is going crazy, killing people, and making willy-nilly choices about the economy? Yes, the answer resoundingly, through the Lamb, through the four living creatures, through the giving of these powers to these four horsemen, resoundingly, God is saying, I am still in control. Don't let this world fool you. Let me pull you up to a divine perspective. Which is the purpose of the genre of prophecy, the purpose of apocalyptic literature. Let me take you up to a divine perspective to see the way in which the world is working from God's perspective. Okay. Revelation chapter 6, verse 9 through 11. Any more questions on the four horsemen before we move on? Okay. Revelation chapter 6, verse 9. When He, Jesus, or the Lamb, opened the fifth seal, I, John, saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and the testimony they had maintained. They called out in a loud voice, How long, sovereign Lord? Holy and true until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood. Then each of them was given a white robe, and they were told to wait a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed as they had been was completed. Right off the bat, I want us to look at something, and it's specifically, I talked about this last week, we'll be asking this question a lot. Where are we? Where are we? Now, the seals is actually kind of interesting because it's kind of hard to determine where John is. Because he sees the seal breaking the Lamb in heaven, but the action is carried out on earth. So it's hard to tell if he's in heaven looking down or if he's on earth looking up. But what we can ask the question in this particular instance then is where are the effects felt? Or where are these seals, the effects of the seals, most adamantly impacted? The first four was earth. The four horsemen were not riding in heaven on conquest, they're riding on earth for conquest. This fifth seal, though, is clearly in heaven. Clearly in heaven. Why? Well, look at the language that's around it. The language that's around them is, when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar of the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God. These are dead souls. These are not living people. And it's why they were killed? Because of their testimony they had maintained. They called out the sovereign Lord, and it keeps going on. How long until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood? These are people that had once lived, but have now died because of their faithfulness to God. We are in heaven. Matter of fact, where's the last time we saw God? Chapter 5, and He was in heaven. We are in heaven in the fifth seal. So the location's established. Now the question is, maintained the Word of God and the testimony through what? Through what time period? Through the time period that's described as the riding of the four horsemen. Or through their faithfulness in the time of Rome's reign. These people maintained their faithfulness, maintained their testimony to God during the time of the Romans reigning, during the time of the wars that were raging. And the question that they have is a fascinating question. They want to know not how long will the world go on or how long till they receive their bodies. They want to know how long until their blood is avenged. Now, I find that interesting because their prayers are a lot different than ours. And I think it has a lot to do with perspective. I mean, when's the last time that we in a church service prayed for judgment to come? When's the last time that we prayed for justice to reign on those that are being unjust? Or when's the last time we asked for God to avenge the blood of our brothers and sisters that have fallen? Now, I find it interesting because sometimes, especially with our prayers, sometimes our prayers in the church, they just don't... We try in everything that we do to match up with the New Testament. You know, with our movement, especially the Restoration Movement, is all about moving back to the first century, being just like the New Testament church. But man, when it comes to the prayers of the New Testament church, we don't pray like them very much. A lot of their prayers are different. Or even like the prayers of the Old Testament, like David and the Psalms. If you read the Psalms, I mean, they can be devotional. They can be gruesome. David praying for the babies of the enemies to be dashed against the rocks. What? And what's weird is we're going to see at the end, at the seventh seal, whenever the seventh seal is broken, you'll have a half hour of silence in heaven, and an angel is going to go before an altar, and he's going to have incense, but then he's also going to have gathering the incense with the prayers of the saints. And then he takes this mixture, and he throws it to the earth as a judgment on the earth. And my question there is, what were the saints praying for on earth? Because if they're praying for what his action was, then they were praying for judgment. See, and the reason why I say it's because of our perspective is we don't have anybody that's oppressing us unjustly. And so a lot of times we forget that this world is not fair to everyone. It is not fair not only to people that are just poor and non-Christian, but it's also not fair to Christians throughout history. Our perspective needs to be balanced with the revelation of God. It should be appropriate, it is appropriate, for us not only to pray for our enemies to be converted, but also to pray for the unrepentant enemies to be judged. Because we have blood of the saints that if their blood is not avenged, they will have died in vain, and that is unacceptable. And the fact of the matter is that their blood was spilled in honor of our God's name. So if their blood is never avenged, our God's name is never put back in the honorable place it needs to be. Because whenever God's servants die, his reputation takes a hit. He has to prove that he is still sovereign in light of the fact that he cannot protect his people, apparently. You see the issues that we're dealing with here. And what's fascinating is that God, after they ask the point, how long until you avenge our blood, what does God say? After more of you die. Not enough of you have died yet. Here, take a white robe. Be quiet, he said. You know, it reminds me of those, you know, my parents go to Hawaii and they come back and all I get is this t-shirt. You know, it's like, you know, they're sitting there like, how long do you avenge our blood? Here's a robe. Thanks. But seriously, how long? Whenever enough of you have died. The full number. I'm waiting for more of you to die.
So they're waiting for the slippers?
Yes, yeah. They're waiting for the slippers, exactly. But the concept is, though, is that even in their death, that's as a result of the four horsemen riding, God is sovereign. How long? Until the full number has died. It almost insinuates that God knows what that full number is. That He is still the one in control. He is the one that calls the shots. Not the writers. Not the empires. God is the one that is in control. And what's fascinating as well is that the way in which victory is attained is through suffering. Notice that. When will we be victorious? When will you avenge our blood? When you have suffered enough. Because victory in the kingdom of God is obtained through suffering. Jesus is the prime example of that. The cross is what gets us our victory. And that is archetypal symbol of suffering. Although, this passage says something else too about God. And it's that He is very patient. 2 Peter chapter 3. His patience is because He longs for everyone to have opportunity to come into the fold. And yet this passage also says that there will be a day when His patience runs out. When His patience runs out, and it will give way to wrath. And that is what we find happening in the sixth seal. The sixth seal is an interesting answer to the question that was just asked. And I say interesting because God could have just said, wait a verse. I'm going to judge everybody in a minute. Which lets me in on a clue that there is a time period that moves between Revelation chapter 6, verse 11 and verse 12. See what I'm saying here? The four horsemen describe what? History. The time period between the first coming and the second coming of Christ. The fifth seal was asked the question what? How long will we die in this whole period until you avenge our blood? When will this be over? They are functioning within the first coming and second coming of Christ. The sixth seal is the second coming of Christ. Everything's going to end. Because chapter or verse 12 through 17, it is very clear that everything is over. Not only are we going to see this scientifically with stars falling, but we're also going to see this numerically. Again, numbers will play in a big portion of these next five verses. So let's go ahead and read them, and then we'll talk about them a little. Verse 12. I watched as he, John, watched as Jesus, the Lamb, opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to the earth, as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. What an image. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, every slave and every free man, hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?" I know my wife thinks I'm sadistic in this, but I'm not. That's one of my favorite verses, verse 17. For the great day, the sovereignty of God, the wrath has come of the Lamb, and who can stand? That's my favorite verse because I know the answer. I know the answer. But that's just a devotional moment. That's a very powerful passage showing the sovereignty of God and yet knowing the answer to the question that grace is we will be able to stand. The logic of this section, though, verse 12, all the way through verse 14, is that the whole world's destroyed. We've gone over this already before. What happens if one star falls to the earth? It's over. What happens if all of the stars of the sky fall to the earth? It's really, really, really over. And that doesn't even count all the islands moving and the mountains moving. I mean, we've already gone over this. The point is, the world's done. However, numerically, John makes this point as well. Because notice the amount of elements that are destroyed on the earth, or with the earth. The elements attached to the judgment. You have an earthquake. You have the sun turned black, the moon turned blood red, stars fall to the sky, the sky recedes, every mountain's moved, and every island is moved. How many is that? 7. That's interesting. Because it's almost like he's saying, All of creation is affected by this sixth seal. Everything is affected. Why? Because the number 7 is the number of completion, and he's hit on 7 elements of the earth of creation that will be affected or destroyed. All of creation is destroyed. Then you move on, and who is judged? You have a group of 7. You have the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, the slave, and the free man. 7 groups of people. So not only do we have the complete judgment of creation, but John in the sixth seal is also saying it's the complete judgment of humanity. Humanity and creation. If you notice, the very first people of the group that's mentioned, the very first, well, 5 at least, is describing the people that would have been in charge of fighting the wars. You see what he's doing there? The people that are being judged are the ones that are inflicting the harm. The kings of the earth. The princes, the generals, these are war terms. The rich, notice he never says the poor. The mighty, every slave, which a lot of times slaves can be very rich in the Roman world. And every free man, matter of fact, their doctors were slaves. Artists were slaves. The point is, though, is through using numbers, John is saying this is the end of everything. The end in which creation is judged and the end in which humanity is judged. He uses the number 7. No one is exempt. And then we have the piercing question. Who can stand? And I know we've gone over this, but I want to go over it again a little bit more. Chapter 7 is the answer to this question. The whole point of chapter 7, the interlude between the 6th and 7th seal, is to answer the question, who can stand? Now I want to read the first 8 verses of chapter 7, and we'll pick them apart just a little. Oh no, I want to stop and say this, because this is something I've actually found recently. Let's go back real quick. In verse 16, it says, they called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of the one who sits on the throne. I've been reading texts that are Jewish texts, but they're outside of our Bible. There's stuff called the Pseudepigrapha, and there's 80 of these documents, and they're very much Jewish, and a lot of times they're written in a couple centuries before Christ and around the time Revelation is written. And in one of these documents, I found that pagans were referring to their idols, and when they were calling out to their idols, they called, it says, the text says, they called out to the mountains and the rocks, and then they spoke to their idols. I find that interesting, that what is it almost they're asking? These seven elite pagan people that constitute the completion of humanity's judgment, they call out to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of the Lamb." It's almost like they're saying, "Idols, why don't you fight for us in this war?" And what's interesting is that in verse 13, even in chapter 9, verse 20, is that we find out that idols, the big problem with this, is they can't move, they can't walk, they can't eat, they can't talk. They're asking rocks to protect them from a living being, the wrath of God. And almost as if he's painting the Romans crying out to their fake statues, saying, "Please protect us from something the statues, the idols cannot protect them." I find that very interesting. But I can't prove that totally yet. And once I do, I'll let you know. Chapter 7. Yeah, go ahead.
When every mountain and island was removed from its place, it doesn't mean it was leveled. It was just moved.
Well, the concept of that again, like if you, like you're talking about in verse 14, the sky recedes like a scroll, every mountain and island was removed from its place. That's to me, it's describing, well, not to me, in Jewish literature, that would be describing the destruction of creation. Everything's affected. If you move every island, I used this before, the global warming example, we're worried about the ice, polar ice caps, people are worried about polar ice caps melting a couple of inches. Because if the ocean would raise by a couple of inches worldwide, we'd be in a heap of trouble. Especially, well, not us, because we're in Missouri. The people on the coast would be in a heap of trouble, but we'd be in trouble too because of potential climate changes. And what I'm pointing, making this as an example is if we're worried about a couple of inches of polar ice caps melting, what would happen if we removed all the islands? What would that do? We'd be in a heap of trouble. Because you cannot change the fragility of the earth. Is startling. There's a book, it's called The History of Absolutely Everything. It's a fat book, and it's written by a guy that was actually a journalist in London. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But he's a journalist in London, but he wrote this book, and he lives in Georgia, I think, now. But it's called The History of Absolutely Everything, one of the New York Times bestsellers. In just chapter after chapter, he talks about if this little thing would happen, everybody we'd be wiped off. Every chapter, if this particular animal was totally extinct, life as we know it would be in trouble. Or if this particular pollen from space came, we'd all be... I mean, he just goes through and it's like 40, 50 chapters of just different ways in which the world could totally explode if we let it. Or if it happened, not if we let it, because there's a lot of it we can't prevent. But he just goes through, and my point in all that is to say, the world is very fragile. I mean, in the sense that while everything functions and we're living in it, like everything is just, you know, totally fine, in a moment, matter of fact, we've escaped quote-unquote destruction because of asteroids and different things of that nature numerous times and we didn't even know it. Numerous times. So if the islands were taken away, the fragility of the earth, life as we know it would be gone. And the fact of the matter is because he ends on those two as being seven, he's saying the complete creation is being judged.
Interesting that they're no longer there, but they're, how can a rock fall if it's not above you?
Yeah, that is interesting. What you're looking at is a recapitulation.
Oh, we're back in that time. Okay.
It's like this. All of creation is being judged right here. But right next to it is all of humanity being judged. It's happening simultaneously, but he can't say it simultaneously. He says one, and then it's kind of like you take two steps back, and then you say the same thing again. But he's focusing on something different. Remember, recapitulation. Retelling of the same events from a different perspective, a different purpose.
Then.
Yes.
He uses then like it came after, but it's still at the same time.
Yes. Yes. Because the word then, tote in Greek, is not necessarily a time indicator. It's a proximity indicator. What he could be saying is all of creation was dealt with and then humanity was dealt with. But the problem is if all of creation explodes, humanity's kind of dealt with then too. See, so I mean, whenever we see the word, especially whenever he says the word, and I saw, that's not necessarily a time indicator as much as it is a progression of a vision. Because remember, in Revelation, chronology, we're all over the map. The beautiful thing about apocalyptic literature is he can hop at any point in history to make his point. And the point is, everything's going down, and who's going to be the last one standing? Is it going to be the kings and the generals? Well, no. Because they asked their gods to help them, and it didn't work out so well. But chapter 7 says there will be three groups that can stand. Three. Which is an interesting number in and of itself. After this, verse 1, chapter 7, John, saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. Again, ask about location. Where are we? Holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. Then I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. From the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. From the tribe of Gad, 12,000. From the tribe of Asher, 12,000. From the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. From the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. From the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. From the tribe of Levi, 12,000. That should be weird, especially for a Jew. From the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. From the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. From the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. From the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. First question, where are we?
On earth?
Yeah. Why do you know that? You're exactly right. We are on earth. Why?
He's talking to four angels at the corner of the earth.
Exactly, yeah. Everything in the first four verses is all about the earth. I mean, you have the four angels hold at the four corners of the earth. They're holding back the winds to prevent damage being done on the earth. And then he talks about consistently the land, the sea, and the tree. The land, the sea, and the tree. The land, the sea, and the tree. He's constantly hammering the fact that they're on earth. But if we have not recapitulated, what can we say? There is no earth. Verse 12 through 14, right? But since we have recapitulated, this makes sense. Because he's not focused on chronology, he's focused on the message. Who can stand? Who can stand? And right now we're on the earth, which presents a major problem for the Jehovah's Witnesses, who say the 144,000 are these group of people that will be with God in heaven, while the other people maybe will spend an existence on eternity on an earth. The problem is 144,000 here are not in heaven with God, they're on earth. No question. That's just a flat-out mistake of not reading context. They just didn't read context. The 144,000 on earth, but the 144,000 are very interesting. First of all, the numbers of them we've gone over already. 12 times 12, number 12 is a number for completion. 12, completion times 1,000, it's a big number. You have the complete number of God's people, which would be referring to the tribes of Israel. Another way of saying the people of God. My question is, who are the 144,000? Two main options. One of them is right. The first option is this. This is describing the nation of Israel. The actual nation of Israel. Ethnic Israel on earth. That's the first option. But there are several major problems with that. The first problem is this. Dan is missing. You notice that? Remember when I landed on Levi and I said, Levi as a tribe?
Oh, they were given service.
Exactly.
And they had the temple. They didn't have land.
Exactly right. The 12 tribes were 12 group geographical locations in which each of the sons of Israel were given that land, that region. Levi was not given land. Levi was not considered one of the 12 tribes. They were the priests. They were the mediators between God and His people. But Dan is totally gone in Levi's insert, which lets me, first of all, that gives me a clue. Number one, something's happening here. And it's not talking about ethnic Israel, because if you want to talk about ethnic Israel, there's no reason to get rid of Dan unless he's trying to emphasize something different. I'm going to read two things for you. In Genesis chapter 49, my question is, why get rid of Dan? What's wrong with poor Dan? Genesis chapter 49, verse 17. This is how Dan is described very early on whenever he's talking about the future. Almost, well, in a sense, predicting the way in which the 12 sons of Israel are going to function in history. And what he says about Dan is this, verse 17. Dan will be a serpent by the roadside, a viper along the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider tumbles backward. That's not something you want to have said about you. That's not good. In other words, what he's predicting is that Dan is going to be a thorn in the side of the nation of Israel. As a matter of fact, and this is some of those books outside of the Bible that are Jewish I've been going through. This is from the Testament of Dan. The Testament of Dan, it's what's called the Pseudepigrapha, the Old Testament Pseudepigrapha, the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. I want to write to you the way in which the Jews, about 150, 200 years before Christ, talked about Dan. Listen to this. Talking about Dan, he says, "For I know that in the last days, you, Dan," notice that, "in the last days, you, Dan, will defect from the Lord. You will be offended at Levi and revolt against Judah, and you will not prevail over them. An angel of the Lord guides them both, because by them Israel shall stand. To the extent that you abandon the Lord, Dan, you will live by every evil deed, committing the revolting acts of the Gentiles, chasing after wives of lawless men, and you are motivated to all wickedness by the spirits of deceit among you. For I read in the book of Enoch the righteous that your prince," listen to this, "is Satan, and that all the spirits of sexual promiscuity and of arrogance devote attention to the sons of Levi in the attempt to observe them closely and cause them to commit sin before the Lord." Notice, even in this Jewish literature, Dan is portrayed as completely pit against who? Levi. And who takes Dan's place? Levi. And isn't it interesting that even in this Jewish document it says, in the last days, you basically will be kicked out. Why? Because your prince is Satan, not God's. And what I almost see John, a Jew, saying is, the last days are here, and guess what? We're not talking about ethnic Israel. We're talking about the kingdom and priests that the church has now become. Remember, Revelation chapter 1, verse 9, John talks about being a part of the kingdom and priests. Revelation chapter 5, 9 through 10, "For your blood has purchased men from every tribe, tongue, nation, and people and nation, and you have made them into a kingdom and priests." Exodus chapter 19, verse 6, talking to the nation of Israel, it says, "If you obey me, you will be a kingdom and a nation of priests." In other words, saying this, one day, the people of the Levites, their duties will be unnecessary. There won't need to be a mediator between God and man anymore. Why? Because you will be a whole kingdom of priests. You will be a whole kingdom in which you can come to God yourself. And what John is saying is the church has fulfilled that. And in this picture of the tribes of Israel, he's saying the church is here. The complete number of the people of God, in which Dan has been taken out, Levi inserted. Levi is a part of the tribes, not the mediators anymore. Why? Because there is no need for a mediator, because Jesus is the one that's mediating. Hebrews talks a lot about this. Jesus is our mediator now. We don't need the tribe of Levi anymore. Or we don't need the Levites. Now they can become a tribe because we are a kingdom of priests. You see what's happening? He's saying something very profound about the ethnic Israel. He's saying that the church is the fulfillment of the people of God the Old Testament was trying to create. The church is the fulfillment because Jesus is the true Israel. Matthew, the whole Gospel of Matthew is pointing at this point. Jesus is the true Israel. He has fulfilled all of the law and the prophets, Matthew chapter 5 says. "For I have not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them." And if Jesus fulfills the law and the prophets, why do you think Jesus picked 12 disciples? Do you think that's just because there was only 12 idiots that would want to follow him? No. He picked 12 for a reason. Because him as the true Israel is developing the fulfilled Israel that came from the apostles. 12 was not an accident. It was purposeful because he was creating a kingdom and priests. What's that?
Make Judas Dan?
Should we make Judas Dan? That's a good question. That's interesting. Possibly. It is fascinating that Dan even has, in Jewish literature, has this lore around him as this anti-Christ figure arising from Dan. Not anti-Christ in the sense that we talk about him in the weird end time talks, but anti-Christ in the sense of against the Messiah. I guess we could make Judas Dan. But we don't really know much about Matthias to see if he's Levi. So, point in all that is this. This is not talking about Israel on earth, ethnic Israel. This is talking about the church, the people of God on earth. As a matter of fact, throughout Revelation, Christ, John, are actually very not that favorable towards the Jewish nation, ethnic Israel, even the city of Jerusalem itself. Not big fans. Revelation chapter 2, 9, he calls them a synagogue of Satan. The Jews who say they are Jews, but Jesus says they are not. He says that in 2:9 and in 3:9. And then in Revelation chapter 11, when he's talking about Jerusalem, he says the city in which the Lord was slain in, which is metaphorically or symbolically described as Sodom and Egypt. Not a big fan of the nation of Israel at this point. Why? Several reasons. Number one, they were the impetus of which crucified Jesus. Matter of fact, Matthew is very clear on this. Matthew 27, the Jews say, "Let His blood be on our heads." Whoa. Careful what you wish for. You know, just it's not something you want to be saying. As a matter of fact, it's fascinating to me that in Matthew, you have five discourses in Matthew, which almost sounds kind of like a Pentateuch. A Jewish law, the first five books of the Old Testament, known as the Torah, that the Jews virtually worshipped, not totally. They were just incredibly dedicated to it. But Jesus gives five discourses in Matthew saying, a new and greater Moses has come, giving the laws to His people. And what does Jesus say in Matthew 28 at the end? Obey what I have told you, like Moses would say. And when did He receive the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Law? When He just went and sat up on a mountain. Like Matthew is saying something profound that John picks up in Revelation. That Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament, and therefore His descendants can officially be called Israel. Not a new Israel that replaces ethnic Israel, but an Israel that is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Ethnic Israel had one purpose, and that is to bring about a Messiah, and they did that. But the Messiah's purpose is to bring about a nation that is transformed into a kingdom and priests, and that is what the church is. So right here in Revelation chapter 12 or 7, you see John hammering this point home in the imagery that he has with 144,000. Now, the 144,000 are sealed, but my question is, what are they sealed from? They are sealed from what? Physical destruction would be one option. How do we think that one goes over? Not too well. The 144,000 on earth are not sealed from physical destruction. They are not protected from the angels physically. Why? Because we've already had the fifth seal broken and we know that Christians die. And matter of fact, chapters 2 and 3, we know Christians die. Antipas was one of the ones that has died. We know that Christians are dying. They're not sealed physically. They are not kept from dying. As a matter of fact, Revelation 2:10 says, the faithful Christians in Smyrna, I promise you that you will see even more persecution. And that you will see even more. You will be put in jail for 10 days. And we see Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna, 50 years after Revelation is written, being burnt at the stake. This is what was happening to them. So physically protected, no. Spiritually, yes. There is nothing that can destroy their soul. And what we find consistently throughout the New Testament is that God is more concerned not with our physical protection, but with our spiritual protection. And you look in Matthew 10:28, 16:26, Mark 8:36. I mean, consistently, He is more worried about the second death. Revelation chapter 2:11, Revelation chapter 20 verse 14. You are kept from the second death. That's what's most important. You know everyone's eventually going to go through the first death. Everyone, except for the very last generation that meets Christ face to face. But everyone's going to die. But not everyone has to die a second death. And that's what they're sealed from. That is what they are protected from, is spiritual death, not physical. Okay, we need to keep moving. Chapter 7, 9 through 17. We're going to get our second and third answers to the question of who can stand. After this, I, John, looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. Where are we? Heaven. How do you know that? You're right.
There's a throne.
And the Lamb's on it, and so is the one sitting on the throne. And the only place we've seen them so far on a throne is in heaven. So this multitude needs to be distinguished from the 144,000. The great multitude is not the same group as the 144,000. It's a different group, and the way you know that is the location. The location is different. from every tribe, or nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes, victory, and were holding palm branches in their hands. That kind of sounds like Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, doesn't it? Palm branches, victory, Messiah. And they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." All the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshipped God, saying, "Amen." Listen to this. "Praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength." 7. "Be to our God forever and ever. Amen." Then one of the elders asked me, "These in the white robes, who are they and where did they come from?" John said, "Sir, you know." And he said, "Yeah, these are those..." I just think that's interesting. It's kind of like a not pointless dialogue. He's keeping the story going, but it's like a Sunday school quiz by the elder, I guess, or something. John's kind of like, "Oh, come on, you know." Because I don't know if John knows, you know. He's like, "Oh, come on, you know." Right? You know. Anyway, elder says, "These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve Him day and night in His temple. And He who sits on the throne will spread His tent over them. Never again will they hunger. Never again will they thirst. 2. The sun will not beat on them, nor any scorching heat. 4. See that? They are completely secure from 4, usually attached to the earth. They're completely secure from the earth. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes." Okay, the great multitude is described in a fourfold manner. Nation, tribe, people, and language. Fourfold, referring to a complete number. A complete number of people that are in heaven now that have come from where? The earth. They've died, they are now in heaven, they have been faithful, they're now in heaven. And we know that because the multitude is before the throne. We know that because this is also where we see angels and the 24 elders and the four living creatures, which in 4 and 5 were in heaven. We also see blatantly, they say in 15 through 17, that they were before God forever and ever and experienced the intimate relationship with God that can only be found in heaven. Because they never experienced the pains or the pangs of earth anymore. And they are standing. So the key to the answer is this is threefold. Who is standing? Who can stand? Number one, 144,000. The people of God, where? On earth. Number two, who can stand? The people of God, the great multitude, where? In heaven. And number three, the angels, verse 11, standing before the throne. All of them have in common one thing, and that is they are all servants of God. All servants of God, the ones sitting on the throne, and the Lamb. The servants of God are the ones who can stand in the great day of the wrath of the Lamb. They can stand before the throne confidently because they have triumphed. They're wearing white robes, the great multitude. How have they triumphed? Because they came from the great suffering. They came from suffering, which would kind of describe a four horsemen-like situation. This is where they came from. They died faithful deaths to the point in which they now are standing before God in salvation. The fourfold list I already described, but I want to talk about great tribulation because we've talked about this some already. What are the options for this quote-unquote great tribulation? A lot of times people take this, and the first option is, this is the seven-year period before the millennium. I don't think that's right. Remember, we talked about this before. People get this from, you have the rapture, which would inaugurate a seven-year period, which usually is referred to as the Great Tribulation, or the seven-year period of tribulation. And then after the 7 years, Jesus comes back for a third time, or a second time, part two, is what they call it, and He begins the 1,000 years. Now, we talked about this before, where if you, which we did a couple of weeks ago, I think, if you take out the rapture, you're in a problem. If the rapture is not legitimate, which, you know, it hasn't been for until 170 years ago, if the rapture is not right, that takes out a major block of this whole overall schema. Because then you never know when the 7 years starts. You see the problem? Just totally pictorially. If the rapture is gone, a major pillar is out of this overall temple. Because now the 7 years only refers to the time period. Well, you have the cross right here. time period lived, then you'd have the rapture right there, 7-year period right there. See how they're, so everything goes? This would be the time period between the first coming and second coming of Christ for them. Then the rapture would happen, the secret rapture. But if you take out the rapture, what do you have? The 7-year period, which the word 7 and year never occur together in Revelation at all, ever. But if you did talk about a 7-year period, the 7-year period would be describing the time period between the first coming and second coming of Christ if the rapture is gone, which I like, frankly. I don't like this part, but we'll talk about that later because I actually think that this goes here. I think the 1,000 years and this great tribulation are the same thing. And we'll talk about that, why that makes more sense later. But the first option is 7-year tribulation. This is fascinating to me. The word tribulation here in the NIV is actually used 4 other times in Revelation. 4 other times. And in all 4 times, all of the renderings describe suffering and persecution that is found in the historical background we've already described. The other 4 times this tribulation word occurs is in Revelation 1:9 when John says, "I, John, your brother and companion, in suffering and the kingdom and patient endurance." It's historically rooted. John is experiencing phlipsis, tribulation. 2:9, when it talks about the churches, 2:9, 2:10, 2:22, all those are the only other 4 times this word tribulation is used in Revelation. The problem is the NIV doesn't translate it tribulation until this time, because I think they're pushing a little bit of an agenda. Because the NIV is written, or it's not written, it is translated by people that buy into this with the rapture in. They buy into that. And so they're not being dishonest, but they are making their view look a little bit more clear. Does that make sense? Yeah, it's a bias. It's a translating bias. Where even if you translate what I'm saying into a different language, sometimes that's dangerous. I've done that actually in Prague, where I was lecturing to a group of people and I was going through a translator, and it was weird because in other words, you had to stop at one point and wait for her to catch up. But then also, you didn't know if what she was saying is what you were saying. And there was actually at one point where this one guy asked a question about the 1,000 years, and I only had an hour. Or no, I had 2 hours to do all this, and I went over the historical background. That took almost 2 hours. I had 15 minutes questions. He was asking about the 1,000 years, and I gave him my answer. And he said a whole bunch back to me in Czech. And I looked at her, and she just said, "He said okay." And I said, "That's not what he said." But what I come to find out later, she was protecting me because he was not very happy with my answer. But anyway, the point is that sometimes in translations, different things can be pushed that's not technically being said. And the point I'm making here is that translating this tribulation here is a little bit, because you would not, your little sensors would not go off if it said they came from the great suffering. Oh, okay, that makes sense. They came from the great tribulation. That almost makes it sound like a time period. I mean, it is a time period, but the great is not trying to talk about a specific 7-year period. The word great is trying to talk about the intensity of their suffering. It's not pointing to a time period, great. It's talking about the intensity of which they were experiencing trials, suffering. So, I have a problem with that. Also, there's no mention of Revelation or 7 years in this chapter or in the whole book of Revelation. And my other question is this. Why would John refer to a 7-year period called the Great Tribulation here in chapter 7, but then never mention it again in the rest of the book? You know? You almost think he'd be counting the years. Now we're at the end of year 3 of the Great Tribulation, the 7-year period. But he never uses 7, tribulation, 7 year ever together. Not here or the rest of the book. And this would be the only time he would mention the Great Tribulation. Those 2 words. Only time in the book. Why? And my other question is, why didn't he mention the 7 years coming to an end? The Great Tribulation ends in Revelation 19 with the coming of the Son of Man. But you don't see that. You don't even see a description of all of a tribulation. You see Babylon fall, and then all of a sudden you see this great white warrior riding. There's no talk of the 7-year tribulation's finally ended and everyone was excited because now they've been relieved of this burden that they could have avoided if they were raptured. There's a lot John could have said to make this very clear. And the reason why I don't think it's clear is because I think we're inserting it into a text that's not saying that. See my problem? These 2 words, great tribulation, have so much packed into them that if you're reading this through and you have none of this in your mind, you're reading this through, your mind would not think Great Tribulation 7-year period. Your mind would think they're suffering intensely. They're going through a lot of stuff. And these great multitude are the ones that were faithful through that great time of suffering. And that would be important for the people that are still on earth that this letter is being written to see the great multitude in heaven that have come from the tribulation that they are experiencing. That's a role model that they need right now. The churches in Asia Minor. They need this great multitude to stand up saying, they made it through the great trials and suffering. How much more can you? You can do this. Overcome, the conqueror will receive, you know, the fruit from the tree of life. You see what he's doing? He's talking about the great tribulation, the great multitude, saying, they made it. And he's looking at 144,000, he's saying, you can too. You want to be able to stand like they can stand. Yes, so what do I think that the Great Tribulation is talking about? The time period between the first coming and second coming of Christ. Because that's consistent throughout the rest of the book of these different time periods. Okay, let me go ahead and just summarize this section real quick because we have 2 minutes. I want to point this out, though, of what happened here. In Revelation chapter 6... let me see. Revelation 6, 9 through 11. This is with the souls and the martyrs. Where are we? We're in heaven. The fifth seal is broken. We're in heaven. Now notice what happens after the fifth seal is broken. Because then you have 12 through 17. Chapter 6, 12 through 17. Whenever the great day of the wrath comes. And where are we there? We're on earth. Right? That's whenever all the islands and the mountains are removed and you have all of the seven group, the kings and the generals, they're judged. Now notice where chapter 7 begins. 7, 1 through, what is it, 8? 7, 1 through 8 goes where? Where are we? The 144,000, where are they? On earth. And then what happens with the great multitude? We bounce back in 7, 9 and following. 9 through, I think I'm getting my numbers wrong. 9 and following is all I have. 9 and following. Where are we back again? The great multitude. Heaven. Notice what's happened. What do we have? Remember that word?
Chiasm.
A chiasm. Exactly. And what's the main point? The point of the arrow. The temple. See what he's making the point. His structure is emphasizing the message to the earth. Who can stand? The 144,000 can stand. And what surrounds them is, what surrounds the earth is a picture of martyrs in heaven and a great multitude that have made it through the tribulation. This is a group in which these people on earth needed to be able to look to. Because they know that very well themselves could be martyrs. They know that themselves are experiencing a great suffering and they need to see victory. Victory in heaven. So what he does is he builds this chiastically to make a point about what's going on in the earth. Stand firm. Stand firm. Because ultimately that will allow you to be able to stand before the throne. Revelation chapter 8, 1 through 5. Let me read that real quick. There's really not too much to say about this. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. That's significant because the first six seals, there was vocalization. Notice that. The first four seals are broken and the living creatures all... It actually, in quotation marks, says, come! The fifth seal is broken and you have martyrs talking saying, how long? The sixth seal is broken, you have all of the generals and the king saying, fall on us and hide us from the Lamb. And then the seventh seal is broken, total silence. No vocalization at all. Verse 2, and I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Notice what this seventh seal is doing. The seventh seal is almost more of a literary device to get us on to the next set of seven more than it is an actual judgment. Because he breaks the seven seals, there's totally silence for a half an hour. And then right after that, you have the trumpets being passed out. So it's almost like the seventh seal is the beginning of the trumpets. Verse 3, another angel who had a golden censer came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense to offer with the prayers of the saints on the golden altar before the throne. The smoke of the incense, together with the prayers of the saints, he's saying something, went up before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with the fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth. And that's why I asked my question, what were the saints praying for? What were they praying for? Because his reaction to their prayers, when they go up before God, is to take the censer and to hurl it down on the earth. And then what happens? Peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. Which points back to what? The throne in chapter 4. It's God saying, I am the one that is making these judgments move. I am in control. It's not chaos. It is my sovereign will being executed. What I am suggesting, though, is this. Intercessory prayer is an act of war. You see what I mean by that? We talked about last week how chapter 4 and 5 were setting up this worship scene, because in Revelation, worship is war. Who you worship determines which side of the battle that you're on. And that battle is raging whether you like it or not. Prayer, in this context, in the seventh seal, prayer is an act of war. It is a weapon of war that the saints are using to utilize their desires for God's name to be honored and for the blood of the saints, or the blood of the martyrs, to be avenged. So what we will find is we have weapons of war being used that are not conventional weapons of war, and yet they are very powerful to elicit this war to keep rolling. That's it for tonight. Your homework is this. And if you don't do any other homework, this one do, because this one is really, really, I think will be cool for you. Find a cross-reference Bible, which is like my Bible. I think a lot of yours will be like this. In the middle, there's a bunch of other passages. And they line up the verses. You look at them, like this one says, I'm in Matthew 27. It says John 19, 13 and Numbers 12, 6. Go to chapter 11 of Revelation. Find a Bible like this. And I want you to look up all of the Old Testament parallels to those verses in Revelation. And what I want you to ask is this. Does this help illuminate my text? The text of Revelation 11. If so, how? And why is this type of exercise important in light of what Revelation does with the Old Testament? Because what you will find is in chapter 11, it is so confusing unless you put it in the Old Testament context. Then it makes sense. So does that make sense on the homework? First 14 verses of chapter 11. Cross-reference Bible. Look at the Old Testament passages. See what it's trying to say. Until then, you guys are dismissed. God bless.